After a long day on the fire ground, does your down under smell like an Aussie bushfire? Try Manscaped and help tame your outback. Use code DTFF20 for 20% off your next order, and there's free shipping.
Hello and welcome to the Volunteer Firefighter Podcast. My name is Scott, and I'm here with two fire friends. I don't know what to call you guys. I got Todd.
Hello.
And I got Ash. And tonight we have three other fire friends from down under. From the Beechworth Fire Brigade, we have Rowan.
G'day.
We have David.
G'day.
And we have Tracy. So, tell us a little bit about what's going on in Australia. It's a tail end of your bushfire season, but it hasn't been very busy, correct?
No, we've had a lot of flood work since October. There's been a lot of floods. So at the moment we've got one state in flood, one state in bushfire, two states in bushfire, I think, and one state that's bushfire and flood. And then we're sort of at the moment just at the tail end of our summer season. We're into autumn or fall, as you would know it. But a lot of fires can happen around this time of the year because it's not as much rain at the moment. It's starting to dry out, and because we've had such a wet 12 months, the grass is pretty high, and so if anything happens in the next month or so, it's going to be probably grass fire. So, but the weather's been pretty mild. We haven't had the big 40 degrees Celsius days, which I think is over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in your temperatures. So it's been pretty.
We're the same as you guys. Canadians
are mentioned. Oh, sorry, guys.
Trying to keep it easy around here. Yeah.
It's actually taking months. You don't have to try to do the conversion because usually when we're talking to the Americans, we're like, I don't know what it ever is in American.
Yeah, so, we haven't had those big 40-degree temperatures like we had in 2019, 2020. Bit of wind, but otherwise it's a beautiful autumn day here in Beechworth. It's about 22, 24 degrees, and, it's great. Coming into the best time of the year up here.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about Beechworth Fire Brigade. It was an interesting. You have an interesting history with three different start dates, it appears, or a number of different start dates. And then, what's your organization like in regards to volunteers and paid and all that sort of thing?
So CFA, or the Country Fire Authority, we're a wholly volunteer organization. There is staff, as in who help look after us, I suppose you could say, but all firefighters are fully volunteer within the CFA. So we don't have any retained firefighters. We're all purely here because we enjoy serving our community. So we work pretty hard to train. A lot of our brigades do. But we have over 1,200 brigades in the state of Victoria. Of them, there's only about 52 female captains, so we're working on that. But in those 1,200 odd brigades, we also have some specialised brigades. We have forest industry brigades that are connected to the plantations. We also have Coast Guard brigades. But we have one brigade that are similar to Beechworth, where they have the urban-rural interface, but they also have Lake Eildon, which is a large inland water area in central Victoria, pretty much, that has their own fire boat as well. So we're quite diverse in that. Our appliances are all similar but different, if that makes sense. Their ages can run from 1 year to over 30 years, some of our appliances. So we have tankers, pumpers, ultralights, which are Toyota Land Cruiser base with water pumps, and they carry a small amount of water on the back. What else do we have, Rowan?
I was going to say, so we've got an interesting split. So we've got about 52,000 volunteers in total.
Thank you.
About 29,000 of those are firefighters. and we've got 1,900 tankers. So most of our tankers run at about 3,000 litres of water. And we have a pump on the back that's between 750 and sort of 950 litres a minute. And the way we do firefighting for the grassland, we'll often be on the back deck of those tankers, either using hand lines, or some of the newer ones have got automated monitors with joysticks you can control from inside the cabin. And some of the older ones have got big manual sort of fixed mount monitors on the back decks. And we'll use those to run along parallel and do grass fire attacks. But in the, we're sort of on the cusp. So to the west of us is largely open grassland, plains, and sort of broadacre agriculture. And to the east of us, we get into the hills, the mountains, and the quite dense and quite dense standing forests and quite thick bushland. So we've got intermixed in that, we've got commercial pine plantations, and it's a requirement under law here. If you've got a commercial plantation above a certain size, you need to have an industry fire brigade, and they're linked in with the Country Fire Authority. So we use same training packages, same communications networks. Over the state of Victoria, we share a common air fleet, and that can actually move across the country. So a lot of that's contracted stuff that we bring in from North America. So there's actually quite a few Canadian and US air crew, and vice versa, Australian ones that do the North American season as well. So you'll see the same frames and same tail numbers, maybe with different call signs, but flying on both sides of the world. So it's that sort of pooled asset piece. But, yeah, heading out to the east of us is quite dense bushland. And, like, this year it's been wet. We've had a wet couple of years. It sort of started raining in 2020, and we've had sort of quite heavy rain for the last 3 years. So it normally takes a couple of years for the bushland to dry out of quite hot temperatures, but their fuel loadings when they dry out are massive. And that's when we get our big catastrophic, it's sort of in the back end of the, after multiple dry years, we get those big catastrophic fires that are quite sort of typical for the southeast of Australia.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by the we always nickname the Mad Max tenders that you guys have, where you get to hang out in the tail end and run the monitor. we built our tender here, and I was trying to ask for one of those. I said, I want to, like the Australians have, I want to hang out the tail end with a monitor. I'm like, that's cool, but we didn't get one.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting, but to be honest, there's a reason that they've gone to the joystick controlled ones. One of the biggest ways that we kill firefighters here is sort of two methods in the bushfire. One is direct fire, burn over, and so all of our tankers are equipped with a halo style system. It's sold as internationally, but it's essentially a whole bunch of sprinklers all the way around the vehicle, top mounted in the wheel wells. And before they bring the vehicles into service, they actually strip them down and replace things like brake lines, air lines, fuel lines, all with heat resistant braided lines. So, and heat shieldings around things like pumps and fuel tanks and whatnot, to make it more survivable, with roll down curtains inside cabins, so big, thick, insulated, silver reflective heat blankets. So that's one. And the second one is tree fall. So eucalypt trees they're suited to our environment in that they can survive multiple years without a lot of water. But one of the downsides of them is the oil in them tends to be super flammable and they can explode with heat. So that's always exciting. And the second one is they're prone to catastrophic limb failure. So they'll shed limbs, which is untidy if you're in a truck under it. So all of our new trucks have got really heavily reinforced rollover protective systems, but essentially tree intrusion bars over the cabin. So the intent of the new vehicles is to keep us in the cabin as much as possible and to reduce that risk of unrestrained guys on the back deck doing said Mad Max thing, because it does reduce your rollover risk. Your exposure risk, your trees come down or you roll it. But saying that, we do have an older tanker and it does have one of those hand-mounted monitors on the side, and it is awesome fun to hang off.
Yeah. You guys also have one of the newer ones?
Yeah, but trying.
Sorry, say again.
Do you guys have just the older one, or do you also have one of the newer model tenders as well, or tankers, sorry?
No, so for tankers, we've got for our brigade, we use a heavy tanker that's got 3,750 litres of water in it and a 950-litre pump, so we've got that. We have an ultralight, which is the one on a Toyota Land Cruiser chassis. It's got a 500-litre tank and a 450-litre-a-minute pump. That's, think like, I don't know, in North America I've seen those ones with the, like on a Ram or an F sort of 350 or something, just for a quick attack, just to get in there and hit it hard, nice and early. So we've got that. We also have a pumper, an engine, Cruel 5. We use commercial chassis in Australia, so you're not going to see anything like a Pierce or a Seagraves or anything. So commercial cab at the front and a custom-built body at the back, but that's a 3,000-litre-a-minute pump. And we also have a Ford Command vehicle that we use for just a straight, like a battalion commander's car, I guess, multiple radio channels, boards for incident briefing and all that sort of stuff.
Which actually belongs to the group, which is, so our brigades, we have our brigade, but then we have a group of brigades, which we become a group, if that makes sense. And so that vehicle actually belongs to a whole group of 12 brigades. We've actually got two of those vehicles, so they're strategically placed. So if... So we manage it for the group, but we tend to use it quite a lot for our own brigade turnouts. It gives us a better point of controlling an incident from. So I could stand there as the incident controller and I've got the multiple radios and that, and then I'll have someone who runs operations, so they'll actually be closer to the fire, guiding our firefighters and telling them what to do, as I'll be liaising with oncoming appliances, the police, the ambulance, Melbourne Firecom, which is who we report back through to on the radio.
Dispatch.
Dispatch channel, because the more information you give them, the less phone calls I get on my mobile phone because they know what's going on, which you still get those calls anyway because they want to know how you're going, and they might send out more experienced our staff effectively, who are all firefighters, but they're our commanders and our assistant chief fire officers will come out and help us as well if they be. I think we didn't, the last fire we had was a shed fire, but we sort of did that quite successfully, kept it to the shed. I think if it had been a hot, windy day or night, though, it would have turned into a bushfire. So I think that was a pretty successful save, that one, because he was right in the middle of the bush where his shed was located. But we don't know. We think it might have been a lithium battery from a drill that may have started it. Not 100% sure, but it made sense. I'm no fire investigator, but I told the fire investigator I think that's what started it.
So it sounds like a lot of similarities, like we refer to our bush truck like that. We'll have like a 300 or 500-gallon tank, and it's on like a Ford or a Dodge 3500 or 550, and they're very similar styles. And then our tenders, we call them, they're our water trucks, because up here, if we call a tanker, that's the aircraft tanker coming in. So just slight different, but for us, like we just have our own little trucks for our community, and then if we need anything bigger, we rely on our mutual aid agreements to the adjacent communities, where it sounds like you guys are all this big, vast group with similar communities that can kind of come in.
Yeah, so with mutual aid doesn't work the way it does sort of pretty commonly in North America, just because our fire service, like for our entire state, we only have 3 fire services. So we have Fire Rescue Victoria, which are full-time paid guys. They're on like a 14-10 shift, and they work, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're rostered on sort of with a four-shift rotating roster. and that covers Melbourne, like most of Melbourne, which is the capital city, Victoria, and a few of the larger towns. And then we have forest fire management, which is like park rangers, essentially, and some dedicated personnel. They're responsible for fires on all the state-owned land, so the national parks. And then we've got the Country Fire Authority. And as I said, we've got sort of 1,900 of our own tankers, for instance, 220-odd pumpers. So we work that. But we're only half an hour away from a state border. So we actually do, I guess it's the same thing, it's just at a higher level, because we do mutual support between states. So it's not unusual to be called out to do strike teams, where we set up strike teams and task forces and send them interstate. But it's not that same sort of very micro mutual aid, because here they're just supporting brigades. We're in the same organisation. We wear the same uniforms. We crew the same appliances. Yeah.
So, yeah, so if we have a structure fire here in Beechworth, for example, it's not just Beechworth that are called. We have like a table of brigades. So all our neighbouring towns will be sending appliances across too. So our supermarket burnt down quite a few years ago, and we had brigades from all over, because we needed more pumpers to get the water through, but we needed water supply too, because our water supply, it's not just we have town water in Beechworth, it's quite limited. We nearly sucked the town dry that night. The way it's set up is quite good, because there's always backup. We always have a brigade to back us up. And if we, for some reason, because we're volunteers and we're all out of town at work or whatever, the next town brigade will be here and they'll make it through to the fire. So we're sort of, the community will never be left without someone protecting the community and how it works with our fire service. So it's quite good in that respect.
So that's an automatic dispatch then. So if you you're saying you got that supermarket fire, your neighboring brigades would get automatically dispatched to that.
That's correct, yeah. So we sit down and we have an assignment area. So we have our area of Beechworth that we're assigned is Beechworth. And then we've got it divided up into about six or seven little sort of more smaller areas, and then the brigade, like Beechworth, covers all of it. But then what we do is we look at one section and go, well, this brigade and this brigade are closer, so they're going to come into that one. But then if it's at the south, we'll have brigades that are closer to the south section of our town coming up. So that means there's shorter driving distance and someone's going to get there a lot quicker than if we have someone from the north having to come down to the south. So it's a large area, and it's not so much that it's what the roads and the bush and everything are in between. So it might, on paper, you look at it and go, oh, well, but they're close, but yes, but they have to go through windy roads and climb up a hill and go through the bush to get to us sort of thing. So it's a bit more technical than if you're in a big suburban area.
What do you do for, like, smaller, like an alarm call or something that's not a working fire? Is the same thing?
And we map it off pre-plan. So we've got a small bush hospital in our town, and we have pre-assigned units to respond to that. So we'll roll three separate brigades to every alarm at that particular instance. So, they'll just respond on the standard. Look, we normally get there. You can ascertain relatively quickly if it's a false alarm or not, and we'll just stand them down, turn them around, and it's par for the course for other properties that aren't such high risk. So we've got a few that are identified high risk. Like, we're a tourist town, so we've got a few properties that hold in the vicinity of sort of 200-plus people. We'll obviously respond more brigades to that on initial response versus just a standard call to a house, you know, smoke in the area or something. So we map the response to the threat, and we assign vehicle type by threat as well.
Yeah.
And do you handle MVIs and medicals as well?
No. No, oh, sorry. MV, motor vehicle incident. Sorry. Motor vehicle incidents, yes, we do for the fire response. We have our state emergency service in Victoria. In this region, they do the road accident rescue. And so state emergency service think like a civil defence organisation. So they do that, and we'll be there to cover off on the fire threat. They'll do the cutting people out. And we have an ambulance service as well, and they do the medical. So we're not running, we're not EMTs or anything like that.
Right. So, like on an MBI, you potentially have like I guess four agencies there, because you'd also have the police. So you'd have like police, crew, the medics, and then the fire brigade.
Correct. Yeah. Huh. And cool. Look, sometimes you end up with a few vehicles there, but. We're pretty practiced. We've got a relatively common command and control system that works inter-agency. We stole that out of the US. We used the same system that the US Forest Fire Service used. We renamed it to call it the Australasian Inter-Agency Incident Management System. We didn't change much else sort of below that. So you have controllers within agency, and then you have an overall incident controller. And depending on what that is, it sort of goes to different agencies. So could be, like, for instance, police are in charge of car accidents in the state of Victoria.
Unless it's a fire.
Unless it's burning, and then we've got it until we put it out, and then we give it back. But it sounds a little bit clunky, but in practice it actually it works quite well. We're well practiced in especially in small rural areas. But we know the police, they live in town. We know the ambulance guys, like we all shop at the same supermarket. Our kids go to the same schools. We all know each other. So that interpersonal thing can smooth over any sort of systemic bumps that there might be along the way.
Which is rare.
Yeah, which in fairness is rare, but just that, like, we know each other. We work together a fair bit.
Yeah, I was kind of curious how that would work. Like, we have some areas of our province where the fire departments don't do any vehicle rescue stuff or auto extrication either, where we'll have a separate group. For instance, like a search and rescue agency may do the highway response for rescue, and then the ambulance is provincial here. So the medics do our thing, and then the rescue agency will do theirs. But in our two towns here, we encompass all of it as well. We do, these guys are doing first responder, so first medical response, and the auto extrication, vehicle extrication.
Right.
So our staff firefighters do emergency medical response code ones.
Yeah, so yeah. That's the paid staff in Fire Rescue Victoria. They're doing that for heart attacks, strokes, those really critical ones. But that's a relatively new and not super common practice in Australia. It hasn't been our history. We haven't had a history of fire service doing that EMT piece. It's culturally, that just hasn't been part of our picture, I guess.
But yeah, the last few years, it's become more common.
Yeah, that's kind of where we are in our department right now. We do we only do the kind of the high acuity calls, like the cardiac arrests and those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're just talking about writing some notes here as well as we go. How often do you guys have training nights? Or we practice once a week, generally, and we have a fire practice night. And then do you guys do mutual training with the other agencies as well?
Yes. Yeah. Do you want me to talk? Yeah. So we train once a week as a brigade. So Thursday night will be our training night. And listening to your previous podcast where you're talking about where you do – set up your scenarios and you've got guys out on the ice and all that sort of stuff. Okay, we don't have the ice to have people out on, but we do the same sort of things where you turn up to a blind scenario and you've got to react to it, and you test and train your crew leaders and your crews and that sort of testing the full sort of facet of your skill sets. It sounds really, really familiar, and sitting there taking notes just to sort of polish up what we do without blowing smoke up you, that it's really, really similar to the same sort of stuff that we're doing. So that sounds, yeah, we're training along the same sort of lines. We've just finished running a new intake of firefighters. We call it general firefighter course, a recruit course. So we had those guys training three times a week. So they had two specific general firefighter sessions where it was just those, that crew. And then they come along to brigade training as well. But it's difficult to teach those sort of fundamental skills within the context of a higher, when you're doing that higher level training, because you don't necessarily have the time just to focus on, well, this is how you actually deploy a hose. This is how you adjust your branch when you're trying to achieve those sort of higher training effects. So we found it good to break that out and run those individually. And we also have Saturday morning, we'll have within the group radio checks on all means and a bit of, you know, station make and mend equipment maintenance, take some vehicles for a run if they haven't had a run that week, just to make sure everything's still turning and burning like it's supposed to. So.
As part of our, rules, vehicles should be taken on a minimum 30-kilometre drive a week. We need to check radios. We check all of our equipment weekly, especially our breathing apparatus and those kinds of things that
safety critical,
those kinds of things. So we have six sets of breathing apparatus for this brigade. We have four on our pumper and two on our tanker, which is really good because a lot of people don't realise or understand that you should be wearing breathing apparatus at a motor vehicle fire or even that shed fire we had the other week. Pool chlorine and batteries and all sorts of shed diesel, all sorts of shed stuff that you might be able to smell it, but it's in the atmosphere. So we're big on trying to really push safety in our brigade, like people to be more aware to wear the P2 masks or to wear the breathing apparatus and, be safe because we don't want people to get sick because we're volunteers and we've got other jobs and livelihoods and our families, so we need to really protect ourselves with that as well. Yeah. But our we do have meetings once a month, so I try my leadership's quite consultative, so I try to work with the brigade on how we're going to do things in the future or how we can make improvements or purchases we can make. We look after fire equipment maintenance for our town and our aligned town. So it's something that the CFA help us with managing because they invoice all the companies and that. But, yes, so we check extinguishers, we check fire hoses, we supply extinguishers. We also change smoke alarms for elderly people in the community or change their batteries. They're all coming to 10-year smoke alarms now with the batteries already inserted. And that's a free – the smoke alarms is a free service. The residents aren't charged for that. And we've got a lot of smoke alarms just going to someone's house for some incident or a reason. So community engagement is a really big part of our brigade culture as well. It's the whole CFA culture as well. And that's Rowan's pager battery. So community engagement is also a big part of our brigade as well. So I think what else we do? We do a lot. It's like a little business. I have a plan. I sat there when I became captain and did a plan of everything I'd like us to do in my two-year tenure. And I showed Rowan and he got excited because he loves a plan. But some of our other brigade members had a bit of a heart attack and I had to explain to them that it was, we do this, but I just need to have it on paper so we can not forget anything and keep on track with our brigade, with our training, our community engagement and that kind of thing. I've even got to do a financial plan, which is a bit of a struggle at the moment, but I'll get there. Yeah. I like to spend money. I like to have to work out how to spend it. Just if I need it, I buy it.
We have Ash was talking to Marshall just now. Marshall Bass from it is Queensland, right? From above you guys.
Yeah.
He just messaged him. And there's a very important thing that we're supposed to bring up.
Yeah, so apparently, let me call it up so I get it right. He says,
What is the message here? Is that Beechworth CFA in Victoria? They've got the bestest lolly shop in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, it's we're a, oh, look, I think we said offline before we jumped on the we're a tourist town up here, and we've got a lots of destination locations in town and within the region, and the lolly shop has the lolly shop, the bakery. We've got a couple of decent pie shops, like properly decent pie shops.
Oh, and then
news agents. But there's few really good breweries, but yeah, we do have a couple of places that are for a town that's sort of, I don't know, our fire response area is sort of 3,000 to 4,000 people. We have a pretty high profile across the country for tourism related locations, I guess.
Yeah, so. Ned Kelly, he was a bush ranger.
Yeah.
Don't know, what would you call him in Canada?
I don't know.
A criminal.
Yeah. Yeah, Australians tend to laud random highwaymen.
No.
I think it parts back to, I don't know, convict upbringing roots or something. So, yeah, anyway, there's heaps of tourist stuff to do, but yes, it is that same boat to Earth. So, yeah.
Now, I don't want to miss this, so I'm going to bring it up. Travis's crocodile story. Now, Travis isn't there, obviously. But you guys,
yeah. So Trav's out. But, look, we live in the southeastern part of Australia, so this is the temperate part of Australia. We have four seasons here. It gets down to, you know, sort of -6, -8 during winter. We are not a tropical climate here by any stretch of the imagination. And it was one of those nights when you sort of get the 2 a.m. call. And you just look at the page and you're like, oh, this one's going to be sporting. And there's a wildlife and animal refuge not far out of town. And Murphy, luck being luck, our actual pumper was out for routine service. We had the spare, and I'm sure like spares everywhere, they're truly loved and incredibly well-maintained machines that they are. And so we jump into this old banger and head out to this job, and we get there and it's the place is going from end to end. It turned out the people that were there, they didn't call the fire brigade until after. They tried to rescue all of their animals first, and it was venting out the roof by
including
the time they...
snakes.
Yeah, including snakes and all sorts of stuff that we expected. And they were trying to rescue all of these things, and you know, it was out the roof before they put the call in. And it was a bit out of town, so it was going like the clappers, basically, by the time we got there, with the potential to impinge on a couple of big gas tanks. So we're worried about exposures down the left-hand side. And, you know, we weren't saving this place. We were just stopping it from spreading. And anyway, we sort of climb over, the wee-high fence to get down this left-hand side. And the owners come out and, for the croc, you know, watch out for the crocodile. And the response was along the lines of, you know, it's not a bloody good time for a joke. You know, we're a bit busy. An old matey's come back and gone, no, it's a legit crocodile. And here we are, it's, I don't know, probably 2 degrees Celsius outside. And everyone's had a bit of a bunker pants turned a bit browner than they had been. Everyone got out of said enclosure. Saltwater crocodiles, like they eat humans. They hunt humans, right? We are not the apex predator in that particular enclosure. We all cagged axe and got out. And a red flag warning went out. And our poor radio operators for Firecom, who were on the other side of the state, you could just hear the incredulity in her voice as she's reading back this red flag warning that everyone on site at the Beechworth, you know, Wildlife Reserve fire is to get back and get out of the enclosure because there's a saltwater crocodile loose in there. And, look, it's not something that I ever thought we'd have to deal with up here. When you're sort of going through your risk matrices of, you know, risks and mitigations and how we can deal with it, saltwater crocs wasn't in it, because they're not. Oh, you've got to head 2,000 kilometers north before you get to salty territory. And anyway, old matey wrestled said crocodile into a toilet and locked him in there. we flagged up the door suitably so no one would incidentally open it. Yeah, I'm not even kidding. And we were quite cautious around said outhouse saltwater crocodile. But not what you expect in the southeast of the country. That's for sure.
But he was safe.
Sorry, who wrestled the crocodile?
Yeah, the crocodile was safe. Yeah. Oh, no, the guy who owned it. Yeah, the guy who ran the place is look, croc wrangling's a bit of a thing, but it's a niche sport, and not one that we're prepared to engage in just quietly.
Not part of the
no, it's not part of our accredited training continuum.
No, no, absolutely.
So wrestling with the outdoors. Wow.
No thanks.
Yeah, no, Steve wasn't
there. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you need someone who's mad as three hatters to go dealing with that sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
We talked a little bit before we started about your obviously 2019 and 2020 was your recent big year for fires. Tell us a little bit about that if you could. We've heard about kind of the northern areas and what I guess the mid areas, but we were talking a little bit beforehand about your experiences.
So in the fires started probably in the September October of 2019, in New South Wales and parts of Queensland as well. So. Incredibly, I saw a photo of a tropical rainforest in Queensland, which you would think never burnt, and then I saw the after effects. There was not one bit of tropical plant left, I can tell you now. The fires, the weather was just crazy. So the CFA were deploying volunteers and appliances to New South Wales to assist with the firefighting effort up in New South Wales. So Rowan went up on two tours up to New South Wales. We then, very close to between Christmas and New Year, it sort of got a bit nasty again, and it actually jumped the Murray River, which is quite a big river. It's probably, can you give it a comparison anyway?
Okay, not big by North American standards.
No.
By Australian standards.
Pretty big river.
And a state boundary between Victoria and New South Wales.
It's a pretty long river. Anyway, it actually jumped the river, which was a bit of a surprise, and headed towards one of our towns, Corryong, up in the north of the state, which isn't actually too far. It's probably an hour and a half drive from here. Also, around the same time, a town called Mallacoota, which is on the coast of Victoria, was surrounded by bushfire as well. So the weather was quite hot, quite windy, high temperatures in the 40s. So we deployed, we had quite a few of our members deployed up to the fires in Corryong. That's the fires for the area that we were helping assist. I was in the Incident Control Centre as well as the District Command Centre, because part of my paid work with the CFA is being in those areas. So I'm a situation officer. If you look at the AIMS concept, that's my role. And we were deploying people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for quite a few days. I spent New Year's Eve till – I didn't celebrate New Year's Eve that year, put it this way. I was in the District Command Centre trying to deploy strike teams for the next day. The wildlife, there was a lot of wildlife killed. There was a lot of livelihoods. There was homes, there was cattle, there was pine plantations were badly burnt as well. It was quite a hard time actually for everyone involved in those fires, and an incredibly busy time, not just for the volunteers but also staff who had to work through that. So we had deployments actually from Canada, North America, New Zealand. They all came across to assist us, just like we'll go and our Victoria will go across and assist those countries as well. Just trying to think of what else. We did.
But for us in Australia, and especially sort of in the southeast, the large fire threats come not from grass fires, because they'll cover a large area, but you can normally sort of wrap those up relatively quickly. And it's when it gets into the forest. And the way especially on the east coast, we've got wet sclerophyll that normally takes a couple of years to dry out. But when it does, it's got insane fuel loads in there. And so that's where you end up with catastrophic fires with, you know, flame heights of well above 50 metres, and you start creating your own weather systems and getting pyroclastic clouding and all that sort of really exciting stuff, and collapsing cloud columns. And
Which happened
multiple occasions through that year. So the fire season actually started up in North Queensland, where it normally never burns. But we're on the back end of 7 years of, well, 6 or 7 years of it being exceptionally dry. And so places that just historically had never burnt since Whitefella turned up to Australia were burning. And it just sort of, the fire season sort of, as it came down the coast, we progressively sort of sent strike teams into northern New South Wales, which is the state above Victoria, then it sort of central New South Wales, then southern New South Wales, and it was kind of inevitable. And then from where we are at Beechworth in the northeast, we actually had a string of lightning storms come through to the south of our town and started a fire complex around, well, they called it the Abbeyard complex, but it was around Mount Buffalo and Bright. So we had fires on the southern front that we were sending people to. We had the one that came across the river from New South Wales. It was around Walwa Corryong, and that touched us up pretty hard. That had some of the worst fire conditions that I've ever seen in 30-odd years. And we were sort of up in that region. And then, so that was sort of from the north. And then out to the east, there were fires in Gippsland that, you know, we weren't effective ultimately in stopping those. They got to the south coast of Victoria. And we had the Navy and Army actually come in and evacuate people on amphibious ships and take them off the beach to get them out of there. So, the Great Victorian Firebreak is Bass Strait, and unfortunately we had to use it on that occasion because it literally burnt from East Gippsland all the way down to the ocean.
There was a real fear that the two complexes were all going to join up, which they didn't, fortunately. But, just the mapping and the predictions were quite, if the weather didn't change and we weren't successful, it was going to be huge.
Yeah, and so we had, and just the effect on the town, although we didn't have fire within, probably 20, 30 kilometres of town, I guess Abbeyard was probably the closest. We had air pollution levels that we were topping some of the highest in the world over that period. So just families and everyone was walking around wearing, we call them P2, N95 or KN95 respirators. People wearing those for a month. We'd come off the fire ground and they'd do the saturated carbon monoxide testing just to see how much carbon monoxide you've got. And you'd come off shift and you'd go back. And by the time you went back, your levels were still higher than what they were supposed to be by the time you came off the fire ground, because there was nowhere to get rest to. And it's not like, get out of the smoke. We had all the way from Adelaide, which is, 800 kilometres to the west, through Melbourne, all the way up to Australia's capital up at Canberra, all the way up to Sydney, that whole section. So we're talking 600 kilometres north of us. Through to sort of 800 kilometres west was blanketed in smoke at a level that pumped your carbon monoxide levels up above what's doctrinally acceptable. But it's it was pretty sporting there for a while, and especially with 100% volunteer organisation, with those really long duration fire complexes, it starts to, well, to be honest, for everyone, it doesn't matter whether it was the paid fire rescue guys, the paid park guys, the Forest Fire Management Victoria, or volunteers, you start getting difficulty in resourcing fire complexes over that sustained period of time. And especially for us as volunteers, we've got jobs that at some stage people have to turn up to in some sort of condition to work. And so it's that balance between, and some employers are great and some, you know, they need their staff. So it's that constant balance of what you can do and what you can get away for out onto the fire ground. And, yeah, and I don't know that that's a problem that we've necessarily solved. We've got a few quiet years now, but when the climate starts to dry out again and we sort of go through that, you know, southeast of Australia, we tend to have sort of 7-year cycles. Unfortunately, we're going to, you know, invariably have to test how resilient we are again.
Right. You, like we get a lot of spotting. Like we get kilometer because of the pine trees. Like we got pine cones flying through the air that are on fire for kilometers. Does that happen with the eucalyptus? You said the eucalyptus trees actually explode, but I'm assuming they don't explode kilometers away. They explode in a probably more confined area.
Yeah.
Do you guys have that, like the spot fire? Is that?
Yeah, we do. And there's not just one kind of eucalyptus tree. There's a whole, there's, I don't know, I'm going to be corrected here, but thousands of different sort of varieties. And there are some that have got like a ribbon bark that comes off. And so that is really, really light. And it's great for burning brands. And that stuff can spot, like, oh, well, there were reported instances in that 2019-2020 fires of it spotting 25 kilometres in advance and 30 kilometres in advance of fire fronts. And that's really problematic to combat. And there's other ones that spot a lot more but much more locally. So, yeah, we do have significant issues with spotting in eucalypts, and it's especially those long stringy bark and the ribbon bark that just gets taken in the uplifts. And it's quite depressing when you're there and you're trying to hold a line and you can just see it, you know, heading over here and you're like, oh, that is going straight up, but eventually it's going to come down. And yeah, that's a really common mechanism for fire advance in the Australian environment. So, for instance, when the fire in that Corryong-Wolwa complex crossed the Murray River, we had the fire front on our left-hand side as we were sort of looking at it driving up the road, and it was probably 5 kilometres to the north of the river, and it was already spotting, like, to the extent that you could see it, and there's nowhere we were going to wrap it up. 5 kilometres on a mountain, 5 kilometres to the south, and it had already spotted and taken off. And they're like, oh, we're going to try and hold the river. And it's like, we're not going to try and do anything. We've already lost the river. That's a really common mechanism for fire spread.
Do you guys, we're really big on fire smarting. So what that means for us is it means, like, the homeowner goes around and they make sure all the leaves and anything that's flammable has gone away from their house, and then they chop down all the trees around them, they mow their lawn or they cut their grass or whatever they're going to do. If a fire does come, we have sprinkler protection units. So we put the sprinklers up just to protect the home, and we let it kind of the bush burn around them. Is that something that's common in Australia as well?
So part of our community engagement is we do CFA, we do property advice visits. So we'll actually go around to, we have the Victorian Fire Risk Register, and they sort of pinpoint, because they found that a lot of people who've died from bushfires live within 150 metres, I think it is, correct me if I'm wrong, Rowan, I think it's about 150 metres of a bush line. So those properties are targeted for visits, and we actually they actually visited and they talk about, because we have our fire danger ratings, and so what's your plan on a day of very high fire danger or catastrophic fire danger, where Some people choose to stay and defend, and so we go through with them what they need to do in that. Some people who live in quite dense bush areas will have the sprinkler systems going. I've known of people who control that all by their mobile phone to protect their property if they're not there. But a big thing is cleaning out your gutters, mowing, taking flammable goods away from your house. Like you put your firewood next to the house for winter, we'll move that away for summer. Clean up all the rubbish in the things that if there is a fire and they burn are going to float up. Protect your, like have trees that might become ember banks so they're like evergreens that might be able to soak up any embers that come through.
We're going to pause if you can hear us.
That kind of thing. So it's really clearing around your home and that. And then we talk to them about.
Not sure if you guys can still hear us, but you guys just froze.
You can to help protect your home. Now, what's your plan? And we encourage them to let their family know what they're doing. Pre-plan. People have horses and dogs and that kind of thing. Where are they going to take those if there's a fire? And so we're very big on. Teaching the community to have a plan and work out what you're going to do for that plan, because we haven't got enough fire trucks or personnel to be at each house. We can't be there for them, so we have to make sure that these people have a plan and prepare their properties, and that's a big part of CFA's summer engagement really is to be prepared. Sounds like the Scouts, sorry.
And one of the other things you mentioned was sprinkler setups that you deploy. It's we don't do that, and we traditionally haven't. It's not a common equipment set that you see in Australia, but we've actually spoken about it as a brigade, and we're in the process of investigating based off, you know, it sounds like exactly what you were talking about, but based off an equipment loadout like the US Forest Service uses with collar tanks, standalone pumps, relatively small hoses, water thieves and sprinkler setups, we're pretty keen to get a unit set of that as a trial, because we have extensive areas of Beechworth that are on that urban interface, and they are well within that. The entire western edge of our town is a high risk area because we come straight out of a really broken ground, quite dense, fire heavy bush, straight into the back of properties. So that sort of setup we think would be ideal for where we are, but we're just in the process of sort of investigating that and putting that together. But that hasn't typically been a tool set that's been used in Australian firefighting very much. I don't know why, but just culturally, we haven't done.
You know, we in our town, we hadn't really used sprinklers much. And then we actually did a course last September. So it was after our fire season was over, but we did a course on it. And the amount of just humidity that I think we had like six big sprinklers out. The amount of humidity we generated just from doing that, it was actually very impressive. And we set it up, and it was actually really simple, because we thought we had to go on roofs with ladders, but we were using 2x4s, and you just screw the sprinkler to the 2x4, and then we literally raise it up like a flagpole and tie it to the building. And then now it's got elevated water in it. It was actually, I was like sold on it, because for a while I'm like, yeah, sprinklers, how boring is that? And also, like, is it going to be that effective against a major fire? But when you start looking at all the videos of the from UL, which is down the States,
familiar with their work.
Those firebrands, like they do those big videos where they blast the firebrands at the house. And I was totally sold on it now. So we're going to get some sprinkler protection. We're not going to do a whole big trailer, but we're going to definitely get some sprinkler protection. You guys just have a trailer.
Yeah, we did the same. We did a sprinkler protection course a few years back, and then we were fortunate enough to have actual trailer at our fire hall for a while. And then when the fire came through our area, we actually deployed a whole pile of it, and it worked fantastic. And again, very small diameter hose. We just call it Econoline. It's like a little garden hose.
Super cheap.
Yeah, yeah, very cheap and easy, lightweight. You know, you connect your sprinklers. And in our training, the first time they just said, okay, go set up your sprinklers. And we put up way too many.
You put up 40 sprinklers. You're like, yeah, we got it. You need like four.
you don't need as many as you think. And it's very impressive. That little humidity bubble with some fire smarting does wonders. And it's a newer concept to our area anyway. I know the BC Wildland Forest Service, they've been doing it for a while now. But for us, it's new, and but it's working.
And it's pretty cool because they actually have trigger points. Like, so the supervisor will go out and he'll be like, okay, so when the fire hits here, this is when we turn the pumps on. So it's basically like, because we have to do water conservation, obviously, because you're only running off of a portable tank. So, you know, when it hits this point, we turn the pumps on and then we leave. And then after the flame front comes through, you push back in and then you do any mop up of the around the structure or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we had a significant, like on our capital, like Australia's capital city, Canberra, we had significant bushfire impact on the western side of that. A while ago now, probably 15 years ago. And there was, well, they lost about 600 odd houses there, sort of the first three rows of houses really in the most impacted suburbs. And the response in the Australian Capital Territory was to go for some big heavy CAFS pumpers so they could essentially from the street coat them with the monitors and the CAFS. And that was the response there. For whatever reason, I'm not really sure, we haven't taken that path identified via that UL research. But that was one of the things that triggered us to start having a look at it and see if we can investigate for our situation.
Right. Oh, neat.
I think we're wrapping up here.
We're coming up on an hour here.
That's
it goes by fast.
It does, yeah. Is there anything more you'd like to add?
Look, we'd just like to thank you guys for the opportunity. It's always good to share ideas from across the pond. There's, you know, we often do it in different manners, but we're all fighting the same threat. So being able to pull those ideas from different perspectives, I think, makes us all better firefighters. So thank you very much for the opportunity to come on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate you guys taking the time.
Absolutely.
You know, for talking across the globe here, which is pretty neat, like you said. The opportunities we have now to share and discuss things. And it's been neat to do since we started doing this podcast and talking with other groups throughout the world,
planet,
I guess. You know, like we all face the very similar challenges, you know, being with the volunteers or paid on call or what have you. It's the exact same cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll wrap it up.
That's been great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time, fellas. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Right. Thanks for the Beechworth Fire Brigade. We actually had a little bit of a tour after we got off the line with them around their fire hall. And I got to see the Mad Max truck.
Yeah.
Very jealous.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very interesting concept, say, how they deco their tenders.
Yeah.
Right, that was really neat to see.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts. Like, we were chatting about the differences of how they're so far advanced in some ways.
And then we're advanced in other ways.
Yeah, to the tactics or to the equipment, and then vice versa for different styles of attacks or different, you know, whatever called styles might be. Yeah. Super, super cool, though.
Yeah, their crew production is crazy. Like, their
that's
spray bars.
Next level stuff, yeah.
Multiple pumps or areas you can pump from. And
mm-hmm.
Mad Max. Actually, and one cool thing we saw was a pre-plumbed suction line.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was like a hard suction and just plumbed, and they can take it right out, and you don't have to try to tighten it down, and it's all like lose the prime and all that stuff. You just open it up and go prime it. So
yeah, drop it and go.
It's amazing.
It's great.
Yeah, that was a very neat concept. Yeah. I like that.
All right. I guess we're down to the shoutouts.
Yeah.
So first up is Modus.
Yeah, Modus, classic claim to fame is going to be their snagger tool.
We use them. We love them. We currently have our laptop propped up on a box that we got from Modus. But yeah, they got their snagger tool. They got their force entry wedges, their soft entry kit. They've got soft bags, mass bags, pocket organizers. Yeah, tons of gear to add to your kit. Check them out on all their major social media platforms. And if you like what you see, use discount code DTFF5 for 5% off.
Todd, Manscaped. At the beginning, I think we can say at the beginning of this episode,
yeah. You
should have heard the Australian Manscaped.
That's so right.
We'll now do the Todd version.
That's right. Yeah. Well, no Aussie bushfire here. But yeah, Manscaped, of course, a big supporter of them. And we really like the product. So we've got their the Weed Whacker and the
Lawnmower
4.0.
Yeah.
And there's a new version of the Weed Whacker coming out as well, which we're looking forward to check that out. Mm-hmm. But again, we know we talked about the keeping clean and grooming and the cleanliness. You know, it directly relates to us into the fire service as well for cancer prevention and whatnot as well. But really like their products. They've got the crop preservers. They've got their other what's the other one? The crop preserver and the what are the wipes called? Again? I keep forgetting the wipes.
Crop mop.
Crop mop. Yep. Yeah, crop mop for the quick little refresh on the go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, check them out and use our discount code DTFF20.
Absolutely.
We'll get you 20% off and free shipping.
Dr. Nick.
Dr. Nick. Dr. Nick Sparrow out of the Kootenays operates under the ATAC group. So that's the Anesthesia, Trauma, and Casualty Care. We went up and saw him and his team. We're going back a few years now. Yeah. For the ATAC conference up in Nelson, BC. Amazing show was put on there. A lot of amazing presenters. And then you guys went back up and took the RTAC, which is the Rescue Trauma and Casualty Care.
Right.
Amazing hands-on experience. Super, super jealous I wasn't able to get involved in that one. And your guys' biggest takeaway is all of the higher fidelity sims, which we always, you know, claim and promote. But with that kind of hands-on training, the way that they instructed, like really got you guys thinking, which then you guys came back and kind of built some of that into your Stop the Bleed presentations and whatnot. But then COVID hit and there wasn't an opportunity to do these hands-on training sessions. So what they did is they built an online portion of it. So you can log in. There's a whole bunch of course criteria. There's a little picture in picture of Dr. Nick in the corner, kind of keeping you in check. But yeah, like amazing show there. If you're interested in that, I don't know if it's available. I'm not quite sure what the deal is right.
Yeah, we're still working on that. Right now. Talking to them about.
Mm-hmm. So hop on the ATAC group, ATACC. Find a little drop down for RTAC. You can sign up. Go through all the online portion of it, and then on the back end of that, there will be some hands on training as well.
Eventually, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Todd, speaking of Stop the Bleed.
Yeah, Stop the Bleed. So three methods of massive hemorrhage control are direct pressure, tourniquet application, and wound packing in no particular order. Carry a good tourniquet. That's what we talk about a lot. And make sure it is out of the wrapper. Ironically enough, I went through my kits on the ambulance the other week, and somebody shoved one in there with the wrapper, so I quickly ripped off all the wrappers off them.
Perfect.
Yeah, so stopthebleed.org or .ca will take you there. It'll give you a lot of information if you want to sign up to be a instructor. And then you can check out our content on YouTube as well. We did a little kind of an instructor's point of view of the course and kind of full course run through. And yeah, definitely if you're going to do the training, make it fun, make it realistic, and high fidelity sims, there is a good buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
Ash?
Wolf Tree. So yeah. Really, really excited to team up with Wolf Tree, local coffee roastery from all over British Columbia. We were sampling their WTF blend, which is pretty sweet last time. This is a different blend, and they do have a couple options. We are really excited to put together a bit of a custom blend. Wolf Tree and DGFF. Scott has tried to steal the bag that we got from them. We were drinking their product pre and during the podcast here tonight. We just got off of a course. It's been a bit of a long weekend. We're currently 11:30 at night. So we are truly fueled by Wolf Tree Coffee tonight. So check them out on their social media, wolftreecoffee.com. They are on Facebook, potentially Instagram as well. They will be shipping in the coming future. So again, amazing product. Taste is phenomenal. And the only thing that's keeping me awake right now.
Tanner Olson.
Tanner Olson Band. Yeah, country music out of West Coast Canada. They are traveling around, playing different venues right now. Awesome band. You know, we had them here for your 100-year anniversary.
Yeah, we did.
It was a fantastic event.
Is their signature right there?
Hey, yeah. There you go. And of course, we're looking forward to them coming back here in May for the spring seminar. They're going to be playing at the Firepalooza. So check them out on all your listening platforms that you download music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lastly, us. So May 5th, 6th, 7th is Firepalooza. I don't even call it the spring seminar anymore.
No.
Firepalooza.
Firepalooza.
Firepalooza, May 5th, 6th, and 7th in Oliver. And we are. I've heard we're almost ready, full up on hotels in the area.
Yeah, the combinations are going to be pretty sparse. So,
well, let's throw some talks away.
Yeah, B&B, and then we'll head somewhere else.
Yeah. We're gonna. I think last check I was we were at 20. I want to say 23 sessions. Anything from I think we had 3 or 4 to 5 live fire, whether it's vehicle fires, positive pressure attack. Just a bunch of different firefighting. And, of course, there's a bunch of rescue stuff in there as well. We got some Stop the Bleed, Top by Top. And we actually have some Dr. Nick's crew down doing some RTAC. A little bit of rescue task force, dealing with active shooter events, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, of course, big party at night,
yep.
On Saturday night with Tanner. Yeah, check that out on our Facebook page if you're in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you search up on Facebook, Oliver Spring Seminar, it'll pop up and you can follow along. And
we have our video up.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's
1,000 years.
Yeah. Full disclosure, we built that. We did that video before COVID, and it was when Avengers was coming out. So it made a lot more sense back then. Mm-hmm. Now it just seems weird.
Yeah. We paid some money and put some effort in.
Yeah, but you know, when you know it's awesome. The Avengers, it's still pretty good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what does somebody say to you? Like, why are you guys so serious?
Yeah, you guys are way too serious. I'm like, no, it was actually supposed to be the
Avengers. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you see the Avengers trailer, like,
the Endgame trailer, yeah.
This makes sense, yeah.
Also us, so DTFF on, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on TikTok, we're on... Yeah.
Twitter.
YouTube, Twitter, check us out on all those platforms. Obviously, you found us on a podcast platform of some sort. Click the like button, give us 5 stars, or as many stars as you think.
Yeah,
hopefully 5. Any more for anymore?
No. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Good night, and stay DTFF.
Also, stay safe.
Oh, and stay safe.